So Judges chapter 11, verse 30. Okay. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the people of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering." So Jephthah advanced towards the people of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord delivered them into his hands, and he delivered them from Aroer as far as Minnith, 20 cities, to Abel-Kermim, and with a very great slaughter. Thus the people of Ammon were subdued before the children of Israel. And when Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, there was his daughter coming out to meet him with timbrels and dancing, and she was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass, when he saw her, that he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to the Lord that I cannot go back on it." So she said to him, "My father, if you have given your word to the Lord, do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, because the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the people of Ammon." Then she said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone for 2 months, that I might go to wander on the mountains and bewail my virginity, my friends and I." And he said to her, "Go." And she sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her friends and bewailed her virginity on the mountains. And it was so that at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, and he carried out his vow with her, which he had vowed, and she had known no man. And it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went 4 days each year to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite. Okay, let's stand and we can pray.
So scene one is called Growth in the Desert. Let's read in Judges chapter 11. By the way, I'm reading from the New Living Translation today, just to keep things a little simpler for us, since there's a lot of fun words to pronounce. Okay, maybe I just did it for me. Verse 1, "Now Jephthah of Gilead was a great warrior. He was the son of Gilead, but his mother was a prostitute. Gilead's wife also had several sons, and when these half-brothers grew up, they chased Jephthah off the land. 'You will not get any of our father's inheritance,' they said, 'for you are the son of a prostitute.'" So we meet our main man, the central character here, Jephthah, and like Gideon, we're going to find out very quickly that he's referred to as a mighty man, this warrior of valor, and that's really over the course of this chapter what we're going to see him become. He's going to become someone that is greatly used by God, but we find out that his beginnings may not lend him to that. He was the son of a prostitute, says it plain as can be, and furthermore, he lived outside the promised land. His half-brothers, the quote-unquote true sons of his father, kick him out. They kick him out of the house. In their eyes, he's worthless. He's second class. He doesn't deserve to be there. But of course, we're only 2 verses in, so let's continue to read verse 3. "So Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob. Soon he had a band of worthless rebels following him. At about this time, the Ammonites began to war against Israel. When the Ammonites attacked, the elders of Gilead sent for Jephthah in the land of Tob. The elders said, 'Come and be our commander. Help us fight the Ammonites.' But Jephthah said to them, 'Aren't you the ones who hated me and drove me from my father's house? Why do you want me to come now when you are in trouble?' 'Because we need you,' the elders replied. 'If you lead us in battle against the Ammonites, we will make you ruler over the people of Gilead.' Jephthah said to the elders, 'Let me get this straight. If I come with you, and if the Lord gives me victory over the Ammonites, will you really make me ruler over all the people?' 'The Lord is our witness,' the elders replied. 'We promise to do whatever you say.' So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him their ruler and commander of the army. At Mizpah, in the presence of the Lord, Jephthah repeated what he had said to the elders." So this Jephthah gets kicked out of the house. He runs away, flees to the desert, and he, like many characters in the Bible now, is going to have his time away in the wilderness. His time apart from society. And for many people in the Bible, this is a time of quiet, secluded growth and change. And so something happens to him there. He doesn't remain alone, does he? In the wilderness, he is accepted. Well, he wasn't accepted at home. He's accepted in the wilderness by other, it says, worthless men. It's interesting how those who are often not accepted by their own people or family or society find acceptance among the rest of the outcasts, and that's exactly what he does here. And this group apparently becomes some sort of spiritual Robin Hood and band of merry thieves. Is that how it goes? They're out there doing whatever it is they do. And as the story progresses, Jephthah has been out there doing this for a while, and the nation of Ammon begins to attack Gilead, and they have no leader, no champion, no one to take them into battle. So what do? They go to Jephthah. Presumably because of the success his band of warriors is having out there in the wilderness, doing whatever it is they do. So now the great irony is the one who is considered worthless is worth very much to the same people that ostracized him. And notice in Jephthah's speech, there's a little pushback from him, but interestingly, there's really no deep bitterness we see, no anger from him, no refusal to help. Interestingly, he has a pretty good attitude about it. Jephthah wasn't shaped by acceptance in the beginning, and he apparently isn't shaped by acceptance now, because everything that he had become was developed outside of the system, outside of the fold. Acceptance wasn't what drove him. It was something else. He had apparently become a very capable and competent leader with this band of, we could say, ruffians, outlaws, but it's because he learned outside of the system. It's sad to see how often people strive to be accepted by the established system. We put on the right clothes, we vote the right way, we pursue studies within a system that often has little or no respect or regard for us if they knew who we were. It can't be helped that Jesus had no desire to conform to the system of his day. Jesus was an outsider. Jesus was a radical, and Jesus also had his time in the wilderness, away from the shallow expectations of the world around him. His purposes were different. He defied the expectations and angered the establishment. And he also attracted his own band of misfit merry men, didn't he? I speak to the Christians here. Why are you trying to fit in when your master was an outsider? Why do we seek to fit in so much? If Jesus, the one who's leading us, was such a radical, why do we seek to conform so much to this world? Why do we seek acceptance from a system that killed our leader? John 15:19, the world would love you as one of its own if you belong to it, but you are no longer part of the world. I chose you to come out of the world, so it hates you. For Jephthah, the world of his day was not responsible for what he had become. In fact, quite the opposite. It was his lessons in the desert that gave him exactly what he needed to succeed, when the establishment could never give him that. This is a reminder to all of us that we are not of this world. And therefore, this world can never make you, Christian, who you're supposed to be. So don't try so hard. Don't try so hard to please this world and the expectations it puts on us. We have to have a higher vision, a higher goal. When crisis hits Israel, the same system that had cast him out now is seeking his help. suddenly incredibly useful to everybody. And Jephthah didn't just return, he set his own terms. Again, his skills, his leadership was uniquely honed in that time in the desert, and he ultimately became the singular, unique key to unlock that door that nobody else could open. And the same could be true for every one of us as disciples in this room. If we make it our goal to follow God and not try to conform to the systems of this world. Learn to grow and thrive where you are. With no bitterness. Learn to grow and thrive where you are, where God has placed you right now. Perhaps you didn't get into the school you wanted, or get the job you wanted, or get the girlfriend you wanted, or get the da-da-da-da-da-da. Maybe this is exactly where you need to be. Maybe this is a wilderness of your own where God can shape you and grow you and change you and build your character into who he wants you to be. And guess what? It's not going to fit in the system. But it will be a solution to some problem in the future. You will fit in where God wants you to fit in someday. Have patience there. Thrive in the desert. Grow there. None of this will be wasted if you let God continue to work in your life. Scene number two, words before swords. Let's pick it up in verse 12. Then Jephthah sent messengers to the king of Ammon, saying, "Why have you come out to fight against my land?" The king of Ammon answered Jephthah's messengers, "When the Israelites came out of Egypt, they stole my land from the Arnon River to the Jabbok River, all the way to the Jordan, and now give back the land peaceably." I want you to notice here, in response to this threat from this king, that Jephthah first attempts to use reason, I guess we could say, and diplomacy before going straight into a battle, which is not what you'd expect from this guy. This is Robin Hood and his guys. And yet, he begins very carefully in a conversation with this king. Despite looking like a tough guy, he demonstrates a lot of constraint here and kind of a desire to reach a peaceful outcome, it seems. Romans 12:18. "If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men." Romans 12:14. "Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse." This guy isn't ready to pull a sword. He began by simply asking a question before allowing his temper to get the best of him. He asks a very simple question. Why? Why? Help me understand where you're coming from. Because you seem like you're coming in pretty hot. This is a great question. Proverbs 15:1, "A gentle answer deflects anger, but harsh words make tempers flare." We might be surprised if we ask this question more instead of getting in arguments. Why? Why are you saying this? Help me understand. Additionally, we find something else that's interesting about Jephthah. If we continue to read now, we're going to find that this guy has a really surprising understanding of history. I mean, the accuracy that he relays here about the history of Israel is really uncanny. So let's read it. Verse 14. Jephthah sent this message back to the Ammonite king. This is what Jephthah says. "Israel did not steal any land from Moab or Ammon. When the people of Israel arrived at Kadesh on their journey from Egypt after crossing the Red Sea, they sent messengers to the king of Edom, asking for permission to pass through his land. But the request was denied. Then they asked the king of Moab for similar permission, but he wouldn't let them pass through either. So the people of Israel stayed in Kadesh. Finally, they went around Edom and Moab through the wilderness. They traveled along Moab's eastern border and camped on the other side of the Arnon River. But they never once crossed the Arnon River into Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. Then Israel sent messengers to King Sihon of the Ammonites, who ruled from Heshbon, asking for permission to cross through his land to get to their destination. But King Sihon didn't trust Israel to pass through his land. Instead, he mobilized his army at Jahaz to attack them. But the Lord, the God of Israel, gave his people victory over King Sihon. So Israel took control of all the land of the Amorites who lived in that region, from the Arnon River to the Jabbok River, and from the eastern wilderness to the Jordan. So Jephthah here steps back and gives the bigger, really big, historical picture. If you found that a little hard to follow, so did I. Here's basically the summary. The Ammonites lost their land to the Amorites, confused already, long ago. As time went on, God led Israel in victory against the Amorites, and thus Israel took the land. In other words, his big idea is this. It wasn't us who took the land to begin with, guys. It's interesting that we can quickly lose an accurate view of history, which apparently this king did. If we lose an accurate view of our history, we're going to find it very easily to get lost in the present. You should have understanding that really these conflicts that continue to happen in the Middle East are a result of the same thing we see here. Conflicts about land. Who did what to whom. And by the way, that land will always be in contention until the Lord settles this. That Israel and its borders and what they took and what was said they were supposed to take and all of the above is going to continue to be in contention. We see this right now today. The same thing happening. People tend to forget history. And typically, the very first things to go out the window is logic, reason, review. Thinking about how we got from point A to point B tends to go right out the window when everybody's yelling and posting and marching, doesn't it? It's worth noting, I think, that we see some intelligence in this man, Jephthah. And I also think it's worth noting that the world is not expecting intelligence from you, Christian, are they? They're not expecting you to be wise or a student of history or have really understanding beyond what they see as a blind faith commitment or to have some kind of simple answers to complex questions. The world is not expecting you to have any intelligence, anything like this. Anything to show for why you believe what you believe, like Jephthah. So surprise them. Surprise them. Don't get in arguments. Know something. Learn some things. Know your history. Know why you believe what you believe. Have an answer. Dig into the history of God's people. Know the questions, know the arguments. And don't shy away from having a conversation. Most of the foolish arguments of our day presume that people will buy into hype rather than research the questions and come to conclusions. Important questions like, how do we get to this point? Who was behind it? Who actually said what? We tend to very quickly move past those things in our day. Jephthah knew his history. He knew where he came from, and he knew what to stand on. He's quite confident. Verse 23. And so you see, he's continuing this letter, it was the Lord, the God of Israel, who took away the land from the Amorites and gave it to Israel. Why then should we give it back to you? You keep whatever your God Chemosh gave you, and we'll keep whatever the Lord our God gives us. Are you better than Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he try to make a case against Israel for disputed land? Did he go to war against him? Israel has been living here for 300 years, inhabiting Heshbon and surrounding settlements, all the way to Aroer and its settlements, and all the towns along the Arnon River. Why have you made no effort to recover it before now? Therefore, I have not sinned against you. Rather, you have wronged me by attacking me. Let the Lord, who is judge, decide which of us is right, Israel or Ammon." So Jephthah's last argument here, well, almost last, is, hey, listen, it wasn't us anyway. God did this. God did this. His stance is firm on God, even if all the logic is rejected by this king. Hey, listen, I stand with God. He sticks by his claim that the Lord gave him the land, and he has reasons for that idea. And then he asks an interesting question. He says, well, how about your God? How about Chemosh? Why didn't he come through for you and get the land back for you? It's a great question. In other words, if your God failed to make you happy, why don't you just go complain to him? The gods of our day offer little more to people than Chemosh. And I oftentimes find that their followers are equally sad. Despite all the complaining against Christians, and Jews for that matter, it seems that those of the world are oftentimes simply dissatisfied with what their gods are giving them. And that's exactly what serving other gods is always going to lead you to: dissatisfaction, depression, anger. If those gods were giving you what you wanted, you'd be happy to serve them. You'd be happy where you are. You wouldn't be complaining about other gods. These guys worship this god, Chemosh, who couldn't deliver. And whenever we worship another god, they're not going to deliver either. They're going to bring us to the same place. Lastly, he reminds them that it had been how long? 3 centuries, guys. 3 centuries since this all happened. That was 300 years ago. This didn't happen yesterday. This didn't even happen to our fathers. This was generations ago. This was a different fight with a different people, a different culture, a different nation. And again, it's funny how in reality today we see the same thing played out so many times. Those who are unhappy in their lives today seek to blame those in the past for their issues. Victims because of some distant hurt that was inflicted. It's really amazing how, you know, you read the Bible and there's really nothing new, is there? It's just the same things repeated over and over again. Scene number 3, the Spirit is willing. This will be a short one. Judges 11:28, let's pick it up there. But the king of Ammon paid no attention to Jephthah's message. At that time, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he went throughout the land of Gilead and Manasseh, including Mizpah in Gilead, and from there led an army against the Ammonites. So Jephthah has said his piece. He's been using logic, patience, reason, great historical perspective on what had happened. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter if everything he said was true, because that's really not what this is about, is it? The king of Ammon had nothing to say. He still wanted to do battle. And I'll tell you, even though we're called to live as peace as much as depends on us, there's still going to be time to gear up for the battles, because they're coming. Okay? So we do what we can to live in peace, to be diplomatic, to be reasonable and logical. But the battle is coming. And now we're going to see the only thing that can help Jephthah come his way. It says the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. We can be peaceful. We can be reasonable. We can be people of logic. But that's just not going to be enough when the battle comes. You need God's Spirit. You're going to be needing to be filled with his wisdom, his perspective, and his power. Because this is a spiritual battle, ultimately. Yes, we're talking about real people and real places, But there's a spiritual battle at hand. Ephesians 6, starting in verse 11, put on all of God's armor so that you will be able to stand firm against the strategies of the king of Arnon? No, the devil. For we are not fighting against flesh and blood enemies, but against evil rulers and authorities of the unseen world, against mighty powers in this dark world, and against evil spirits in the heavenly places. Therefore, put on every piece of God's armor so that you will be able to resist the enemy in the time of evil. Then after the battle, you'll be standing firm. We need God's Spirit to succeed in this battle. We need it. It's not an optional thing. We need his wisdom, his power, and his perspective. And now Jephthah is going to truly be used by God here. He's going to muster an army. He's going to go to war against Ammon. And he's going to make a regrettable mistake. Even after being filled with God's Spirit, clothed with God's Spirit, this man is still a man, and he's going to make a regrettable mistake. Scene 4, the flesh is weak. Pick it up in verse 30. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord. He said, if you give me victory over the Ammonites, I will give to the Lord whatever comes out of my house to meet me when I return in triumph. I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. So Jephthah led his army against the Ammonites, and the Lord gave him victory. He crushed the Ammonites, devastating about 20 towns from Aroer to an area near Minnith, as far as a way of Abel-Karamin. Sure. In this way, Israel defeated the Ammonites. When Jephthah returned home to Mizpah, his daughter came out to meet him, playing on a tambourine and dancing for joy. She was his one and only child. He had no other sons and daughters. When he saw her, he tore his clothes in anguish. Oh, my daughter, he cried, you have completely destroyed me. You've brought disaster on me, for I've made a vow to the Lord, and I cannot take it back. And she said, Father, if you have made a vow to the Lord, you must do to me what you have vowed. For the Lord has given you a great victory over your enemies, the Ammonites. But first, let me do this one thing. Let me go up and roam in the hills and weep with my friends for 2 months, because I will die a virgin. You may go, Jephthah said. And he sent her away for 2 months. She and her friends went into the hills and wept because she would never have children. When she returned home, her father kept the vow he had made, and she died a virgin. So it has become a custom in Israel for young Israelite women to go away for 4 days each year to lament the fate of Jephthah's daughter. So to summarize here, before he goes into this battle, it seems that Jephthah wanted to hedge his bet a little bit and made a vow to God. If I win, whatever comes out of the door of my house when I get back home, I'll offer it as a burnt offering to you. And we know there's the story. He goes. God grants the victory, a decisive victory. And upon returning home, to his dismay, the first thing that comes out of his home was his daughter coming out joyfully to meet him. And it says that she accepts her fate. She mourns for 2 months in the hills, and then he fulfills his vow. We'll talk about that in a second. So what of this vow? This is a pretty famous section of Scripture. What exactly happened here? What did his vow actually mean, and what should we learn from this? So what did this vow mean? Well, there's really a divide here. And if you're hoping I was going to take a stance, I don't know if I will. Here's the two options. Number one, the plainest reading in this text is that he offered his daughter as a burnt offering, because that's what his vow was. If you just read it in most translations, he said, I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. In other words, he killed his daughter, much like the surrounding nations would sacrifice their own sons and daughters. That's option one, but there is another possible translation of verse 31. It's this: I will consecrate it to the Lord, or it will be for a burnt offering. Meaning that depends on what comes out of the house. Maybe it'll be a burnt offering, or maybe it'll be something that's dedicated to the Lord. In other words, in that line of thinking, he would be dedicating his daughter to the Lord, kind of like a Jewish nun. She'd be chaste for the rest of her life. She wouldn't get married. She would serve the Lord. In either case, this is tragic. However you want to take this, we could argue all day long. And trust me, some do. Either way, this is tragic. Her fate was decided in a moment by a decision of her father. Her future, her entire future, was decided in a moment. And not only was that a tragic result for her, it came back on him too. He said, "You've destroyed me." That enemy army couldn't destroy him, but his daughter's fate would. No matter how we look at this, this is a terrible situation both for her and him. For her entire future was decided with just a quick word, a thoughtless word. What did he expect to happen? I mean, you think about it. It actually comes out and makes the point that this was his only daughter. Dude, are you doing the math here? You got one kid, maybe a couple dogs. Is that a good gamble? Whatever comes out of the house first? What did he think was going to happen? I think that's a problem. I don't think he was thinking very hard. Let's step back and discuss this idea of vows from a biblical perspective. A vow is simply this. It's an oath, a pledge, a promise. God makes them in the Bible. His people make them in the Bible. They're all over the place. We could find specific examples of vows, the Nazirite vow in Numbers 6. We can find specific people making specific vows to God. Jacob, if you remember, said, "If God, you'll be with me, I will tithe one-tenth of all that I receive." It's a vow. Hannah made a vow. If the Lord granted her a son, she would dedicate him to the Lord for his entire life. So these vows are quite common. We see them all throughout the Old Testament, especially. Ecclesiastes 5, verses 4 and 5. "When you make a promise to God, don't delay in following through, for God takes no pleasure in fools. Keep all the promises you make to him, for it is better to say nothing than to make a promise and not keep it." Jesus, in the New Testament, spoke about vows, famously in the Sermon on the Mount. Particularly, he's speaking to hasty or short-sighted vows. Matthew 5, verse 33. "You have also heard that our ancestors were told, 'You must not break your vows. You must carry out the vows you make to the Lord.' But I say, do not make any vows. Do not say, 'By heaven,' because heaven is God's throne. You do not say, 'By the earth,' because the earth is his footstool. You do not say, 'By Jerusalem,' for Jerusalem is the city of the great king. Do not even say, 'By my hand,' for you cannot turn one hair white or black. Just say a simple 'Yes, I will,' or 'No, I won't.' Anything beyond this is from the evil one." So Jesus here is teaching not about outright rejecting vows, but he's saying, if you're going to do this, be really careful. Okay? He's not saying don't make vows in business or marriage, but he says don't be senseless about it. Don't be too quick or rash to make a commitment or a promise. Some people make such impulsive promises and swear in exaggerated ways, as Jesus was pointing out of emotion or immaturity, and really what they're saying is, "You can't trust what I say." And they find the need to bring other things into the equation. And Jesus is simply saying those things aren't necessary. They shouldn't be necessary in your life. Your word should be enough. Simply say yes or simply say no. And the most important thing is follow through on what you say. Follow through. Now, I couldn't help but be reminded of another infamous vow, perhaps the second most infamous vow in the entire Bible. This is Peter's vow. The night Jesus was betrayed. Do you remember it? Matthew 26, verse 33. Peter declared, "Even if everyone else deserts you, I will never desert you." And going on to verse 35, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never deny you." And it says all the other disciples vowed the same. Quite the vow. Quite the vow. And we know the results of this infamous vow, don't we? How did that go? Within a matter of hours, vow was broken. Not only do they not stand up for Jesus, they outright deny him verbally, and they also scatter and run. So here, Jesus' greatest bunch, how are they doing with their vows? I mean, their vows are pretty admirable, aren't they? I mean, hey, we'll stand up for Jesus. We'll take a stand. We will not be moved. We will be there for you, and it doesn't work out. And we certainly get the sense that Jesus wasn't impressed with their vows, was he? I mean, if you listen to what Jesus said, he said, "Peter, you're gonna deny me tonight." It's almost to say that's cute, but it's not going to work out. So they're admirable, but Jesus is not impressed. And if you continue reading this story, Jesus not only receives these guys back, but forgives them and still has a plan and a purpose for them. So these guys broke what you could say was probably the worst vow possible, as they betrayed God. And yet Jesus forgives them. In fact, he goes even further than that. Jesus kind of fulfills those vows in reverse. Jesus would, in fact, never deny Peter. Jesus would, in fact, on that very night, die for Peter. It turns out, Jesus is going to show himself to be more committed in his people than we can ever be to him. That's going to be a rule. And this is probably what Jephthah missed in all this, I think, that God was actually better than he thought. That God was actually more committed to Jephthah than he thought he was. Did the Lord give him victory because his vow? I don't think so. Hosea 6:6 says this, "I want you to show love, not offer sacrifices. I want you to know me more than I want a burnt offering." I think God was looking for Jephthah's trust, and yes, obedience, but trust. Trust that God has his back, that God was going to handle what needed to be handled. And so we might be left thinking now, this is amazing, God. Thank you that you're going to handle it all. Maybe all this talk about vows gets us a little agitated. It makes me a little nervous, all these commitments and things like that. It's pretty extreme talk. I can absolve myself from these crazy vows. God's got it under control. But back to Peter, you know what? He actually did eventually keep his vow. For history tells us that Peter would die for Jesus. That eventually he would become a martyr for Christ, crucified, if history is correct, crucified upside down. But listen, it wasn't because Peter was oh so committed to Jesus and he's just going to stand and suffer through all this. I don't think that's why. It's not because he was so tough and so committed. I think it's because he finally understood that Jesus was committed to him. Jesus was committed to him. And he loved God for that. He loved the Lord because the Lord did it all first. And this drove the commitments in his life that cost him his life. And so here we have the flip side. Does God ask for our commitment? Yes, he does, but only after we understand his commitment to us, knowing that we love him because he first loved us. But there is a cost. There is a cost. Luke 14, starting at verse 25. Familiar scripture. A large crowd was following Jesus, and he turned around and said to them, "If you want to be my disciple, you must, by comparison, hate everyone else. Your father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even your own life. Otherwise, you cannot be my disciple. And if you do not carry your own cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple." But don't begin until you count the cost. For who would begin construction of a building without first calculating the cost to see if there's enough money to finish it? Otherwise, you might complete only the foundation before running out of money. And then everyone would laugh at you. They would say, "There's the person who started that building and couldn't afford to finish it." And so, yes, Jesus says, count the cost of commitment before you commit to me. Love me and follow me. Jephthah here was willing to give up anything, or so he thought. When he came right down to it, it's quite painful for him to follow through on his rash commitment to the Lord. So I ask you, what personal cost will be there for you to follow God? What individual cost have you considered in your following Jesus? Have you thought this through, or are you a little unclear or confused as to what God is actually asking for, like our man Jephthah here? Find out what the Lord would have from you. Dig into Scripture. There will definitely be a cost to following him. Make sure it's the right cost. And make sure you understand that Jesus is far more committed to you than you ever will be to him. It's got to start there. Our last scene, scene 5, the battle after the victory. Starting in Judges 12, verse 1. Then the people of Ephraim mobilized an army and crossed over the Jordan River to Zaphon. They sent this message to Jephthah. "Why didn't you call us to help you fight against the Amorites? We are going to burn down your house with you in it." Jephthah replied, "I summoned you at the beginning of the dispute, but you refused to come. You failed to help us in your struggle against our struggle against Ammon. So when I realized you weren't coming, I risked my life and went into battle without you. And the Lord gave me victory over the Ammonites. So why now have you come to fight me?" After winning a battle, what would you expect? Well, I would expect to find rest, a breather. Rest in that victory for a while. Yet, for many in the Bible, and certainly for us, if we're honest and we're truly following, there are many times in the Christian life where there's no time to pause after battle. It's on to the next one, and possibly the next after that. Yes, there are times of rest that the Lord grants us, but there is also a time where we must continue to fight one battle into the next. This is the reality of the Christian life. If we let down our guard after winning a spiritual battle, we are in great danger, because that's a great time for the enemy to strike. That's an opportunity for him. He'll bring the fight from where we don't expect it, and that's exactly what happened here. These people from Ephraim were sort of supposed to be God's people too. It's funny, because this is kind of, you know, part two with these guys. Back in Judges 8, if you remember the story, these guys did almost the exact same thing with Gideon. After a battle, they came out and they complained why they weren't invited to join in. Funny, in this case, they were. They forget to RSVP. What happened here? They were invited. Some people, it seems, leave their houses every day ready to get into a fight. They thrive off conflict. They're looking for faults in others, and they're satisfied only when they prove that they're victims of some kind of illusionary plots against them. Just looking for conflict. And sadly, this happens in the church too. These Ephraimites remind us that some people are going to be, sadly, a repeated pain in the side of churches and church members and church leaders. It's supposed to be the same team, guys. Sometimes those who are lazy become jealous or critical of those who showed up to serve, who participated. Although everyone's invited to serve, participate, enlist in classes, even apply to missions trip, not everyone takes up that offer. And so oftentimes it seems that when those who do step up to take the offer, there's always a person or two who becomes critical or jealous. It's in our nature. And it's a sad thing. So many times, people who are not looking for opportunity to participate suddenly become offended when somebody gets a service position or gets to go on a trip or has something wise to say. Listen, if you're sitting around waiting for the perfect opportunity to serve or get involved, I can tell you this emphatically, you've already missed it. You've already missed it. Because there's multiplicity options for service, involvement, participation in this church and other churches. The door is open in many ways. And so if you're just waiting for the stars to align, listen, they have probably many times already for you. Right now, there are people who are in the battle, who've stepped up, who've stepped in and are being used by God simply because they showed up. They said yes. It's sad to see the level of tempers that can happen supposedly between God's people, like we see here. Philippians 2:3, it says, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself." It's funny to think about it. If all these guys had worked together, what a force they would have been. Yet there's infighting. Verse 4. The people of Ephraim responded, "You men of Gilead are nothing more than fugitives from Ephraim and Manasseh." So Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and attacked the men of Ephraim and defeated them. Jephthah captured the shallow crossing of the Jordan River, and whenever a fugitive from Ephraim tried to get back across, the men of Gilead would challenge him. "Are you a member of the tribe of Ephraim?" they would ask. If the man said, "No, I'm not," they would tell him to say Shibboleth. And if he was from Ephraim, he would say Sibboleth, because people from Ephraim could not pronounce the word correctly. Then they would take him and kill him at the shallow crossings of the Jordan. In all, 42,000 Ephraimites were killed at that time. Jephthah judged Israel for 6 years. When he died, he was buried in one of the towns of Gilead. So these Ephraimites appear to be doubly angry with Jephthah here and his ragtag group, not only because they didn't get to win the battle, but also because these guys weren't part of the in crowd. Did you catch that? Jephthah has proven himself, proven his worth as this kind of outsider figure, and he's been used by God, yet he still gets the critical eye from the professionals, doesn't he? This happened in Jesus' day with the Pharisees, and it's sad it still happens today here in the religious world. And so once again, Jephthah must go to battle, this time with his own people, with God's own people. And so he sets up these blockades in the fjords, and they make everyone say this password, Shibboleth. Depending on what culture they came from, they're either going to nail it or they can't speak right. And they judge everyone on that one single word. And sadly, 42,000 meet their end in those fjords because they can't say a word right. And again, This bickering and fighting among God's people here is sad to say, see, and I'd like to say that we're past all that, but in many ways we need to keep on guard against this. It's easy to get so over-focused on the wrong issues. Forgetting that we're part of a bigger team, part of the body of Christ that has a lot of diversity in it. Yes, there are issues to divide over, but we need to be careful not to assassinate a brother or sister because of something that they say differently than us. They don't have quite the right way of doing things or saying things. I don't know if we'd think this way so much, but Jesus quite bluntly called out his disciples, Luke 9, verse 49 through 50. John, the apostle, said to Jesus, "Master, we saw someone else using your name to cast out demons, but we told him to stop because he isn't in our group." But Jesus said, "Don't stop him. Anyone who is not against you is for you." How much better if God's people would be if we were not causing unhealthy divisions because of this professionalism or jealousy or secondary theological issues. I think God has more for us, and we need to keep on guard. I don't think we're tremendously guilty in this church, but it's something we need to continue to be aware of. We're fighting on the same team, or at least we should be. And so there we have it, five scenes from the life of Jephthah. How are we supposed to view this guy? It's a great question. Well, Hebrews 11, I'll let the Bible speak for itself, mentions his name alongside King David and Gideon as what? People that acted in faith. People that followed God and successfully acted in faith. Was this man flawed? Oh, you bet. Did he make a tragic mistake in his life? Yes, but God still continued to use him. He was effectively growing in God and executing his plan for his life. But it is a cautionary tale. It is a cautionary tale about making rash decisions, making foolish commitments. It's about counting the costs and understanding what God has actually called us to, not to get off on the wrong foot, and to know that God does love us and is far more committed to us than we could ever know. And that should be the basis for our love and commitment to him. Let's all stand.